Hello, this is Molly O'Neill. I'm the author of Mostly True, a memoir of food, family, and baseball. And I wish that I'd read Judith Barrington before I sat down to wrestle with my own personal history. Miss Barrington's book, Writing the Memoir, A Practical Guide to the Craft, the Personal Challenges, and Ethical Dilemmas of Writing Your True Stories, is unflinchingly honest and just the sort of companion one dreams of having on that solitary road between telling stories and creating art. Primarily known as a poet, Ms. Barrington is the author of 4 volumes of poetry, as well as the memoir Life Saving. She says that she loves the memoir genre because it requires so many of the same skills that writing poetry requires: gorgeous and inventive language, a sense of rhythm, and the willingness to be honest without knowing all the answers. We spoke about the difference between writing to heal or exercise the past and writing to create an enduring work of art. Even before we spoke, Miss Barrington had said, and I'm quoting her, "When you sit down to write about an event, it's critical to have enough distance from the emotions of the event to consider the literary merits of what you put on the page and to revise for the purposes of creating the best possible book, even if it means leaving out things that are important to you personally. If you are still too involved in the experience, you may inadvertently demand things of your reader, things like sympathy or indignation or revenge. Readers don't want to be co-opted onto your side if it's a story with sides. They don't want you to manipulate them or try to get from them what you haven't gotten from people in real life." I knew then that I was about to speak to a courageous and uncompromising writer, and I was a little afraid before we sat down. Almost immediately, however, I was engaged by Barrington's warmth and wisdom and found it difficult to stay in the interview head. I just wanted to talk to Judith Barrington nonstop for the next few years. And here we go. Judith, it is just such an honor to be speaking with you. I can't imagine.
And with you, likewise.
I'm so thrilled to be talking with you. I can't imagine anybody in their right mind not reading your book, Writing the Memoir, before sitting down to write their own personal histories. I certainly wish I had.
Well, there's always more memoirs. That's one good thing about but the memoir. It's not like an autobiography where you probably do it all in one book.
Yes. That's a good point.
People ask me, what's the difference between memoir and autobiography? I mean, I usually say the difference is just one little preposition. An autobiography is a story of a life, and a memoir is a story from a life.
Oh, and that's great.
You know, there's lots of memoirs in most people. It's just a matter of finding the way in.
Mm-hmm.
And your way in is clearly food. I liked something you said, actually, on your blog. You said something about the power of food to unlock memory, which made me think, because I don't have a lot of food in my memoir writing. So,
Well, that'll be interesting.
I'm going to think about that.
You know, I'd rather build on your previous interviews than repeat them. But I would love to ask you just a little bit about your early years. You grew up in England, where you had a relatively demanding classical education. Is that fair?
Well, I didn't feel demanding at the time, but I feel like I got a good education. I went to an all-girls school. I had a lot of Latin, which is really helpful in terms of learning other languages. But the drawback to the education at the time, which is a very long time ago now, was that the education system in those days required that at age 11 you pick sciences or arts, and I picked arts, and so I was a complete nincompoop about science for years, and still am, really. But I read popular magazines and popular books, particularly about the research into memory, because as a memoir writer, I'm really very interested in what they're finding out about memory.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no grounding for that. I had a very good education in the arts, but not in the sciences.
Well, when was it that you began writing?
Oh, gosh. Probably in my teens, I wrote poems. I certainly didn't show them to anybody. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, actually earlier than that, I had these little red notebooks. I wrote adventure stories of a stuffed horse that I had. named Jerry. And of course, they were very, you know, he prevailed in through terrible hardships. And I've never actually written fiction since then. But I did sit for hours in rainy old England in the winter writing these stories in these little notebooks.
You were an only child, so supposedly you...
Actually, I had a brother and sister, but they were so much older than me that they had left... They were 15 and 11 years older, so I did actually grow up like an only child.
So you had probably a good deal of solitude as a child.
Quite a lot, yes.
I always felt that served me well.
Were you an only child, too?
Not at all. I was just much older. Then my parents started producing boys, like a litter of puppies.
They were out rolling around in the mud when you were writing something.
So I was constantly seeking refuge in my poetic little person, trying to explain to the world how I was so much better than them, and it was all a big mistake.
That's nice.
Now, you're best known as a poet, but your first published writing was actually more journalistic and political in nature. Is that fair to say?
That kind of writing which you're talking about, which was most, I did op-ed pieces for which I syndicated for a while, it was sort of concurrent with poetry. I mean, I was writing poetry and publishing it in small literary journals at the same time, but wanted to try my hand at seeing if I could get paid for anything, any kind of writing. And so I was writing particularly feminist op-ed pieces around current happenings that were going on in the world, and did that for quite a while. Not all the time, but when anything came up that I got passionate about, I would do that.
And were there lessons that you learned from writing opinion that served you as a poet and eventually as a memoirist?
I sure learned about... I learned to write to deadline, which I had never done before. I mean, I was one of those beginning writers who felt like you had to wait to be moved till the spirit moved you. And then I realized that that's not how writers really are. So I learned, you know, if I was going to do it, I had to do it in the next day or two. And then I also learned about being edited. I was fortunate in one of the first editors I had in the Oregonian newspaper, which published a lot of those pieces of mine, was an extremely good editor. And I have known a lot of writers who have sort of adversarial feelings about editors even before they start. And I developed an ability to see that an editor could be a great help. I mean, also, I also learned that, you know, if they had to fit the advertising in, they might chop the last paragraph off my piece. That wasn't so much fun. But I did learn some things from doing that that kind of work, yes.
I found that it served me very well, though in the end I think I was very much a captive of that form, and it gave me very particular challenges when I began writing outside the journalistic form.
Yes. Well, I think that's true because I've had students who are journalists. I actually did a workshop for a group of Associated Press people one time. I mean, they had a huge aversion to using the word I, as I recall. And I think lawyers are also tricky to help over that bump into the memoir, being the sort of intimate talk to the reader.
Yeah, I call it the I word, and I still struggle with it, even though I've been writing personal essay for 25 years. It still makes me nervous.
Well, you know, when I'm teaching memoir, I try to... My students ask me about, you know, well, why would anybody care? Who am I? I'm nobody, and that sort of thing. And I always tell them that the goal, I think a good goal to have is to seem to your reader as if you're very self-revealing, but absolutely not self-obsessed.
That's a great distinction.
Because, you know, who wants to read a book by someone who's just, who comes across as being totally full of themselves? And yet, of course, to write a memoir, in some ways, for a while at least, you do have to be a little bit full of yourself, but you sure don't want to come across that way, I don't think.
Max, you once said that you began writing your memoir, Life Saving, because you needed more space to explore its subject. Your parents had died unexpectedly in a boating accident.
Yeah.
And Life Saving looks at your journey back from that trauma.
Yeah.
Did the act of writing take you through your own resistance and to a deeper emotional truth?
Yes, writing the last chapter did really reveal some things that I didn't know. I don't think that one can write memoir in order to do what you need to do in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just don't think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I do also believe, and this might seem contradictory, that both in poetry and in memoir, what you write does need to surprise you sometimes.
Surprise the writer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you,
yeah.
The writer. Yeah,
yeah.
You need to write something that you didn't expect to appear there on the page.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely true in poetry, and I think that was true for writing Life Saving too, because I had written it to have the last chapter be going back to where my parents were buried in Gibraltar,
right.
Sitting at the graveside, you know, telling them all about my life and everything. And at some point, it was very clear to me that that was a terrible stereotype in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, it implies to the reader that you've resolved everything, you know, it's all tidily wrapped up, that's the end of this journey.
Mm-hmm.
And also because it's sort of like a Spielberg movie, you know, you go to the gravesite. And so I had to figure out more, that I had to go further. And that so much of writing memoir is about going further than you think you need to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the final chapter, which really revealed to me quite a lot of things about what they call survivor guilt and, you know, having somewhere in my being, having lived for decades with the sort of distant thought, what if I'd been there, could I have saved them? That sort of thinking. And I had never really thought that until I put that chapter together.
Hmm.
So I did learn something.
We were surprised by it.
Mm-hmm.
In another interview you gave not that long ago, I'd love to quote you. What you said is, I didn't work through the emotions on the page. I worked through them before I started to write the book. It took me years to be ready.
Yes.
I don't believe that writing in any genre is a substitute for therapy. Even though you may get new insights into your experience in the process of writing the memoir.
Right. I just don't think that people who are in a place where they still need to be doing therapy about a particular story of their life, that they are also at the same time able to have the writerly eye and the sort of the unscrupulous editing person. If what they're trying to do is also work through the issue for themselves,
mm-hmm.
they don't seem to go together.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think if the therapy finds its way into the memoir as visible as that being, if the writer of the memoir seems to have an allegiance, at least in part, to her own or his own therapy, then I think the writing does not shine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the writer's allegiance must be to the story and nothing else when
mm-hmm.
they're writing it.
Mm-hmm. But how do you police yourself? How do you tell if you're serving the story or serving, you know, how do I tell if I'm serving my need for self-aggrandizement, revenge, or soliciting pity or any other kind of alliance from my reader? Those are pretty sticky things.
Oh, they are, definitely, because especially with really hard, you know, experiences where we feel like we've been wrongly treated, it's terribly tempting to want to get the reader on your side and say, yeah, you know, look at this, wasn't I hard done by? But I think that if you're, the more experience you get as a writer, and you've got a lot of experience as a writer, you you know that at least if you put it away for a little while and then go back and take that giant step backwards and read it as a reader and not mm-hmm. as the writer and not mm-hmm. as the hero of the story, but simply as a reader, that you learn how to pick up on those subtle bits of the whiny tone or the, you know, the pleading for sympathy tone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find that you're not sure, you find other good readers who are going to be honest with you about it.
Mm-hmm. So do you work with a group of other writers, or do you have readers you trust?
I have in the past. Right now, I have not got a permanent writing group. But I do have readers that I trust, and my memoir that I'm working on now, that I'm pretty far getting towards the end, is going off to somebody who's a real memoir expert who has offered to read it, so I'm excited to have mm-hmm. that feedback.
I think it's semi-connected to this, but one of the greatest problems I have when I sit down to writing any kind of memoiristic essay or even longer form is struggling with, am I serving the persona I've created, or am I digging below that? Am I digging deeper? That persona is a bag of very well practiced tricks, and
yeah.
I think we all have them. But to me, my writing never really works unless I'm at the very edge of my comfort zone.
Right.
Don't you think
that's that thing about the persona is in a way it's a bit like in life, you know? I mean, if you're the kind of person who goes to a party and you have a persona that is successful and liked and mm-hmm. and so on, that's the one you take through the door into the room where the party
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as memoir writers, we can get too stuck in the persona on the page that we do well and that might be entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Readers I have who I trust and get feedback from often tell me that I need to stop being entertaining. You know, this is not a thing you're going to write just so you can stand up in a bookstore and give a reading and they're all going to laugh. I mean, that's very seductive, but if it's serious material, I have to find a way past that particular, for me, that's the particular persona that I
mm-hmm.
always, that I, that is my defense, really.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I do agree with you that we have to be aware of those personas and just, let them come up in the air once in a while, but actually bypass them and find another tone, another voice from time to time.
I find that mine becomes the most active, and mine is either humor or the sort of winsome, romantic voice.
Yeah, well, we all want to seduce our readers, don't we?
when one of those comes up, I'm generally dancing around something I'm afraid of.
Yeah.
And I'd be the last to know, but boy, do I dance fast. Have you found any particular techniques that serve you well when you're avoiding something, when you're afraid and you're looking the other way?
I think that you have to find, and you sound like you know that you're dancing around and you know that the winsome or the, you know, that particular voice. I think you have to take, I don't know, not a very big chunk, but the place in your writing where that persona is really come into her own and is just in full-fledged mode, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to try to find, read it really slowly, several times aloud, and find somewhere in there, there's a phrase that will tell you, now, here's where I should develop something. I should turn
mm-hmm.
a right angle and just give myself an exercise for, you know, four pages from here with not going on in that winsome voice, but just if you can find it, sort of like I think of the deep truths in memoirs being like the secret garden, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about food as a way in. Well, I think there were many ways in, and that secret garden has a huge wall around it, and hidden in the ivy there are these very old rusty gates, and if you can open one, you can get in there. And somewhere when that persona voice is in full-fledged mode, there is a little gate somewhere, but you've got to find it yourself, probably. Mm. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Mm. It's always easier for me to find it in, you know, colleagues and friends' work,
yes,
or even students' work.
Oh, yes, yes, me
than
too.
Than it is in my own.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, once we've distinguished between serving the story and serving our persona or our personal therapeutic needs, whatever that is,
mm-hmm,
the memoirist is still stuck with the slippery nature of memory. And you've, as you mentioned before, been increasingly interested in the science of memory. What have you learned about the science of memory?
I know that some of the recent research that has been done, and I reiterate that I read this in popular science books or magazines because I'm not at all smart about this stuff, but I know that there have been quite clear statements made about memory changing over time, so that it's not, you don't put a memory in the file cabinet and get it out 20 years later the same.
Mm-hmm.
That how we remember something is very linked to how we need to remember it now, as opposed to maybe the day after the event took place. So
mm-hmm,
as we change and grow older and have more experience in our lives, how we remember things from long ago does actually change. And that is actually changes in terms of, you know, lighting up different parts of the brain and stuff. So they do actually study those things. So what that brings up, I think, for a memoirist is we have to embrace the fact that our memories are undeniably unreliable. I mean, you know that your siblings remember, your brothers remember, mm-hmm, their life at home quite differently than you do. So we've known it all along. We've known it about accidents and witnesses and blah, and all of that. So I think that knowing that memory is unreliable, that one of the things that we have to probably try to avoid is defining the word truth. Because people talk about memoir as a true story, and I say, well, whose true version are we talking about?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I personally prefer to think of memoir as being an honest story. I think memoirists should be honest.
Mm-hmm.
They should not pretend to have had things happen they never did happen. They should
mm-hmm
not pretend to go to fight in wars that they never went to. it's happened. I mean, and those are the ones that get all this horrible publicity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think an honest memoirist speaks from a place of knowing or of grappling with remembering, and that readers understand that you try to remember and you try to make sense of those memories, and as you make sense of those memories, you perhaps remember more.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a static thing, that memory being truthful. It's an ongoing process, I think. And I prefer to use the word honest rather than, mm-hmm, honesty rather than truth in memoirs. And I think a writer of memoir can be very honest and say, you know, I have no idea. I can't remember what happened during that year, but it was really important, and I've always wondered about it. I mean, we
mm-hmm
can speculate a lot and
mm-hmm
be honest with the reader, and we can even posit possible scenarios without saying definitively this is how it was or this is what this other person thought in the situation, because we just don't always know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I hope that's making some sense.
No, it makes huge amounts of sense.
I'm grappling with this all the time because, you know, there are people out there who just, I feel like they're just waiting to seize on some mistake in somebody's memoir and use it to prove that the genre is a lesser literary genre than something else. But it doesn't make any sense, really, why they dislike it so much.
Well, I call that the junior high school of literary criticism.
Yeah, you're right. Very good.
I mean, in fact, maybe some of the underpinnings of that have to do with the popularity of the memoir.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that first novels are increasingly memoir.
Right.
How can you account for that shift?
I'm not entirely sure. There are a lot of different theories, and the publishers were fighting for years, saying, oh, the memoir boom is over, it's too late, but it's just boomed and boomed. And one thing that I think, and I don't think this explains it entirely, but I think that during my lifetime in the last 10, 15 years, people's lives seem to have gotten crazier and crazier. There's no time to sit down and talk, tell stories, basically, to friends. We don't sit around a fire and say this and this and this. And I have a group of friends who actually, we've known each other for a long time, and we actually noticed this at one point, that we knew each other very well, but we really didn't know much at all about each other's lives before we'd met. And so we created what we called our biography group, and each person took a whole evening to just talk about their earlier life in whatever way they wanted. And this is the sort of thing that I think doesn't happen very much. And I think some people read memoir because they want to know about other people's lives, and in particular how other people manage things that are presented to them, not only difficult things, but certainly difficult things. And it's a human, it's almost like a human need that is met less than it used to be. I think that's one of the reasons why memoir is popular. I think it's also one of the reasons why readers get absolutely enraged when they feel deceived by the memoirist. I think we have to be reliable and be seen to be reliable because they feel personally affronted if they've trusted in that way and find out that they've been lied to, deliberately lied to.
Well, I think that there's a lot of pressure. I mean, what you've just said, it says that there's a need for the quieter memoir, that we don't necessarily have to have fought a war or flown to the moon or battled drug addiction we don't have to have triumphed over the impossible the right to tell a story,
and it's in a lot of ways what makes it worthwhile and memorable is beautiful writing. I'm somebody asked me this just the other day at Stanford, was like, you know, well, aren't there any sort of cheerful, joyful memoirs? And I just came to my mind a friend of mine out here who Barbara Drake, who's a who's a poet, who wrote a memoir about starting a sheep farm out in Oregon, and it's just about learning about sheep, and then sheep give birth, and she, you know, but it's beautiful, and you like being there all the way through this little memoir, and she's a poet, and she writes beautifully. It seems to me that our current iteration of the memoir is beautiful language and a pleasure to read, not necessarily an overly dramatic life or a very famous person. Although, of course, the people who have the overly dramatic lives are the ones who get noticed a lot. And I think that we have to ignore that for a while. You can do nothing. You can't create the kind of life, suddenly get a dramatic life so you can write a book.
Oh, I just remembered. I was in Cambodia. I wasn't
right.
In Columbus, Ohio. I was in Cambodia.
And then when I was 27, I lost my left leg. Yes, this one is really realistic, but...
Yeah. But we are noticing I'm noticing more and more poets writing extraordinary memoir.
It's true. Those two genres seem to be like going arm in arm, don't they? I think it's interesting that poets are moved to write memoir. One of the classes I taught several times lately in the last few years was called The Poetic Prose of Memoir. And because I don't like it when people compliment beautiful prose by saying, well, it's really poetry. You know, mm-hmm. like Virginia Woolf's The Waves is always like, oh, it's really a poem. But in fact, I think it's just beautiful, beautiful prose. And mm-hmm. so I like to try to tell people we can use the tools that the poet uses, the rhythms, the beautiful sense of language, the all the, you know, the imagery, all of it, mm-hmm. and yet it can fit into a prose rhythm rather than a poetry rhythm. And poets writing memoir tend to have those tools right there in their pockets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I started out as a poet, and I know that when I'm writing a memory-driven piece, mm-hmm. I'm far more exacting in my use of language.
Yeah.
And the rhythm, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. rhythm of how a paragraph is coming together or how a page flows.
True. And I think, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just wondering, you know, what you were talking about before about sitting around the fire telling stories. Those stories have a cadence. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, the oral tradition is so linked mm-hmm. to music.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the natural bridge.
That, yeah.
It creates a memorable prose. What can you repeat? You repeat rhythm.
Right.
That's what remains in the mind, or at least that's what remains in my mind.
Right. I think that's true. And I think that one of the challenges of writing memoir, which I believe is, you know, definitely uses story, and story is what keeps the reader turning the pages, but it's also musing, I call it in my book about writing memoir, speculation, trying to make sense of that. So that I think it's Patricia Hamilton says that, you know, the memoir writer has to both show and tell. And I think when you move into the telling and the trying to make sense and the sort of more essay-like mm-hmm. aspects of memoir, keeping that rhythm going and keeping it all in one long piece of beautiful rhythmic prose is one of the challenges, because mm. you're moving between those modes sometimes.
Mm-hmm. 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 You know, I wanted to go back just for a moment to the way that trauma and shame have really been co-opted into wild commercial successes.
Mm.
You know, does a great disservice to those writers who can release a lot of energy from trauma and shame. Not necessarily that they're writing about that subject, but that their experience affects the way that they perceive their lives. And yet then, you know, when you're writing about something, even if it's secondhand, that is tremendously traumatic, it's a very, very difficult dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I've worked with many students who just despair when they reach those points in stories.
Mm.
They don't want to go there, and they also doubt that anyone wants to read that material.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Have you worked with people who struggle with issues?
Yeah. I mean, I've worked with a lot of people writing memoirs. I remember one from a long time ago who had been very severely abused as a child, had to change and actually move to a different state because she was afraid of her stepfather when the book came out. I've worked with people who've got very, very severely, you know, violent stories to tell. I don't think anybody can do it till they're ready. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't feel like it's my place to push someone to do something that's that hard.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like I can point out, I think the way you phrased this question was, you know, that they don't want to go there and they don't think anyone else wants to go there with them. You said something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I have found, and I did find this when I wrote writing the memoir, I interviewed quite a lot of people who had written memoirs, and I asked them about how they dealt with the people in their stories, you know, the people that also entered that those stories, and where they were. Did they show the writing to these people ahead of time and what have you? And the one thing that I did learn from that was that almost universally, that what they expected, the reactions they expected to get from people who were mentioned in their memoir, were almost universally wrong, incorrect. If they thought someone would be upset, the person wasn't. If they, there were people who were upset because they weren't mentioned. Sometimes even in one case, someone thought they were a different character in the story than they were.
Right, right.
And what I concluded from that was that a great deal of people's concern and the sorts of statements like, well, I can't write that, my mother would, you know, until my mother's dead, or I can't, my brother would just kill me, or whatever, those things, are actually, they believe those things, but they're actually, what would be probably truer to say would be, I don't want to write that. I'm not ready to write that. I'm afraid to write that. Therefore, I'm going to say that somebody else can't tolerate it. When really, the writer herself cannot tolerate it at that particular moment in time. And I do some, I mean, I don't feel like I push a person to do it if they're not ready, but I do point out that if they're saying that kind of thing, that it's possibly just one of the many clever things we do as writers to avoid the hardest part.
Writing
the hardest material.
Right.
We're good at coming up with these, you know, these reasons why I can't possibly do that.
You know, it'd be great to start a little list of those, wouldn't the
yes.
lexicons of why not, a lexicon of why not, yeah.
Well, people always say it's because first they have to clean the house and stuff, and that's sort of on a very superficial level. But, I mean, you get down to, I can't do it because somebody else will be really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you've got to start, it's complicated. You've got to sort of look at, is that really true? If so, you know, what do I do about it? Or is it, am I just saying that because I will be hurt by getting back there?
Or I'll risk my position
in
another person's life.
Exactly.
Which you always do if you write.
If you write about people, yeah, that's true. But I think you have to know. I mean, I think you have a. I personally believe that you have. You're entitled to tell your story, and that it will overlap with other people.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think you have a huge responsibility to be realistic about what the consequences to other people might be. You know, getting them fired. You know, ruining a relationship with a child, their child. You know, I mean, things that you have no right to just not think about carefully and seriously.
And do you show people your writing or talk to them prior to publishing something that is about them?
Mostly not. No, not really. My partner is a good editor, so she sees things. Sometimes that includes a bit of our life together, but mostly not. I think it's opening a can of worms to do that. And you know, I mean, it's your book. I think if I was in doubt that something, if I was really in doubt about if there could be really bad consequences to a person about my revealing a fact about their life, then I might check that. But I wouldn't ask them to just read it and say, you know, do you like how I've portrayed you or
right.
that sort of thing. I wouldn't do that.
Right. Now, you're just finishing your second memoir.
Right.
And are you ready to talk about that book yet?
No, not really. I need to actually be finished before I think that's the answer.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to it whenever it appears. It can't appear quickly enough for me.
Well, me neither, because it's been a lot of years, and I've put it away many times, and I've thought I finished it a few more times, and then I went back to it, and this time I just have to get there.
How many years have you had this particular book in mind and been working on it?
Oh, I'd say probably 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm. That sounds normal to me.
Yeah. Life-saving took a long time. I mean, both sort of gestating and actual writing and revising. I'm a very slow writer, and with life-saving, having written some poems with some of that same material to do with my parents' death, I knew that it was getting in the way of writing anything else important. It was a story I had to do it before I could get on to something else.
Right. Right.
And it was trying that was the case, but it was definitely true. You have these stories that are your kind of heart germinal stories that sometimes, unless you do write about them in some way, they're always popping up where they don't belong.
Yes, in my case, like in the middle of a recipe or something.
Yes, exactly. Oh, how trying, how difficult that would be. I find it amazing that I'm talking to someone who's a food writer. You said something on your blog about, you know, writers who tell me they don't have food stories or something about they're ashamed of their tuna fish casserole past, and it really made me stop and think, because I'm pretty much known to be not much of a cook, and then I think, well, but there are. If I think about my family and eating and sitting around the table, there are a lot of stories there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Joanne Beard's book, The Boys of My Youth? Have you ever
No,
read that?
It sounds like I should know it though.
Oh, it's a memoir. It's very entertaining, and she's got some great dinner table scenes. I actually have one as copied in and as a handout. I'll send it to you if you like.
Oh, that'd be lovely. I'd like to see that.
It's about
that.
Being a kid at the dinner table, and and I'm thinking, oh, I have dinner table stories, even if I'm not much of a food person.
Well, that's what it's about. It's about the stories around food.
Yeah.
It's never, I mean, food means nothing without its story.
Yes.
It's just food.
I have someone who's kind of a friend here who's coming to the Spain workshop, actually, and has recently written a series of memoirs that are related to her mother and food. Her mother, I think, committed suicide, but each section is a different meal.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I told her the other day that I thought you were going to come, and she was totally thrilled.
Well, I'm doing everything I can to get there,
yeah,
and I was just in Portland. So
oh!
I'm sorry I didn't...
Oh, you have someone at Reed, a daughter at
Reed?
Yeah,
my stepdaughter is at Reed.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was at Reed yesterday, actually, for the Baroque Orchestra. They have a concert there.
That's a riot.
You were just here last week?
I was, yes.
Hmm.
Yes.
Portland's great.
Portland's terrific.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you know, memoirs bear witness, it seems to me. And in your earliest writing, you were bearing witness to social inequities, specifically
mm-hmm.
feminist issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As you matured, it seems to me that you're mining deeper and deeper levels of your own experience and trying to find the universal notes to give words to universal experience. Do you think that that's a typical course of a maturing writer?
Well, you come up with these questions, don't you? I think that the notion of universal is a bit dangerous,
mm-hmm.
because I think that when a writer tries to be universal, that the writing gets much less specific and much less heartfelt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in some ways, I think that writing becomes more universal when it gets more specific
mm-hmm.
and more true to its own story, even if that story is not true for a lot of other people. But the writing that speaks to a lot of readers is often the one that's the most truthful about it, the writer's own experience, even if it's different experience. It's difficult for me to explain that, but I think I think aiming to be universal is a big pitfall.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think, what is it, Alice Walker, she went to China. Her work is translated all over, and she went to China, and these Chinese readers of hers said something like, she said to them, I wouldn't have thought my stories about the South of the United States would really mean a lot to you. And they said to her, oh, no, your stories are very Chinese.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, yes, because she gets to the humanity and the heart of the story, which is, mm-hmm. it makes it universal, even though the specifics are completely not universal.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I think that in my own writing, if I get more universal, it isn't really because of the subject matter, for example. In fact, the memoir that I'm working on now, which I just said I wasn't going to talk about, there's a lot of that book which is about political activism in the 70s, my mm-hmm. own personal story of that, which is mm-hmm. definitely not everybody's experience. But I think it's important. It's an important mm-hmm. part of my life, and my life has really kind of run parallel to a lot of big social changes that I've lived through. So I'm trying to write the personal story that's in that context.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not trying to be universal in the sense that I mean it's my very personal take on those times.
I think I was very awkward in how I phrased my question. I see more universal themes. I don't see you sitting at your desk thinking, how can I be universal?
No, I didn't mean to impute that you did. I guess I just went off there.
No, I think I just had an image that as we mine deeper, mm-hmm. The trench becomes increasingly narrow. You know, it's almost as if we start from a very wide well,
right?
You know, of these separate lives, and the deeper you dig, the closer you get to connecting.
That's true. Yeah, I couldn't. What a nice way you put that. Yes, exactly.
Mm.
Isn't so often when we talk about writing, and particularly talk about memoir, there's so many archaeological metaphors that come up.
Right.
We're always digging.
Well, Annie Dillard is the greatest. I mean, you know, with the digging.
Yes.
The digging metaphors.
Yeah, really.
What craft or habits are the most important things, do you think, for the aspiring memoirist to develop?
What craft?
Which parts of the craft or even daily habits?
Yeah, I've never really believed in this thing that writers say, I sit down and write from 8:30 until 12:40, you know, mm-hmm. and I go out and drink two bottles of whiskey. the old story. Having the habit, I had a very regular writing life a couple years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. I used to go, we have a writer's room in our library, and I would mm-hmm. go every day, and I would be there at opening time, and I would write. I loved that life. I have had some health issues, so my mobility is not very good now, and I don't particularly want to spend my writing time getting there and carrying my laptop, you know, and
right.
so on. So I do have a writing room in my house, so I've reverted to writing at home,
mm-hmm.
and it's working out fairly well. Marge Piercy once wrote a nice essay, and I have no idea where it was, but it had to do with not becoming dependent on your routines, on your tools.
Mm.
You know, when you say you've got to have the candle and you've got to have the right pen, and she said, and what about when you get on the plane and they won't let you light the candle? You know, writing on planes is a great opportunity.
Right.
So routine-wise, I try to put it at the top of my list of priorities, but I do have, mm-hmm. I have teaching responsibilities here and there, and I do other things that I can't bypass sometimes. And craft-wise, I think that what you have to develop as a writer is the thing that you know perfectly well you're worst at. And for me, it's dialogue. I am not good with dialogue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, for someone else, it's, it's description or it's mm-hmm. time, passing mm-hmm. through time and losing the reader all over the place. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just knowing what you don't do very well and mm-hmm. Practicing it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all, I mean, all of the tools of the storyteller are, and of the essay writer are things that you have to develop as a memoirist.
Yeah. I want to just thank you so much for taking this time out of your own writing day. I'm just thrilled to have been able to talk to you, and very, very eager for your next memoir.